Dobrý den všem divákům TV Zemědělec. Dovolte mi na úvod, abych vlastně poděkoval za tu možnost využít tady toho studia krásného a představím vám na úvod dva významné hosty, které se nám podařilo dovést do České republiky a s nimi budeme dělat rozhovor. Welcome Frank Mittener. Pan profesor Mittener je jeden z největších světových expertů na vlastně dopady skleníkových plynů a vůbec vlastně fungování zemědělství a propojení těchto dvou záležitostí. A pan Steve Winnington je genetik z firmy Vorweizer, který má tu zkušenost za 20 let, že projel většinu zemí světa a může porovnávat vlastně, jak se aktuálně s problémy týkajícími se globální oteplování vyrovnávají chovatelé na celém světě. So I would start now in English to ask you, probably my question will be always short, your responses will be longer, but that is why you are here. Our farmers are scared by still repeated argument that they are doing a bad job because their cows are producing methane and they are basically doing harm to our population and to the complete globe. What would you tell them? Can you make it more clear if it is true or not?
So your cows are ruminant animals, and ruminant animals have a very interesting detail to them, namely that they can digest things nobody else can. They can digest things such as cellulose, the world's most abundant biomass. Without ruminant livestock, that cellulose could not be digested. So that's a beautiful thing. But the problem is when the microbes in the digestive tract of ruminants digest that cellulose, they produce methane. And that methane is then belched out. It's coming out of the mouth. Some more methane comes from the animal manure. So that's true. But the question is, how much of a problem is it? It is true that methane is a potent greenhouse gas warming our planet. But what's also true is that while it's potent, while it's a strong greenhouse gas, it has a short lifespan. It's not in the atmosphere for very long. And if you manage to reduce methane over time, you can reduce global warming. And that is what offers a real opportunity for farmers. If they ignore this problem, we have a problem. Mm-hmm. If they manage this issue, then they can reduce warming and be part of a solution.
So basically, if we used to have 20 years ago almost double higher number of cows, and now we are only in the half number, does it mean that this automatically itself is reducing the pollution of methane in Czech Republic?
In the Czech Republic, between 1990 and today, you have cut your cow population in half. And you have doubled milk production. And that means that over time, your methane went down. It didn't go up, it went down. So that in itself has helped for sure.
Is it only the total production of methane that is what's going on? Or is it more important to connect it to how farm is productive, how good is, how is improving production, how is taking care for the animals?
It's all of the above. On the one hand, you do want to reduce total methane. But the way you get there is through what you just mentioned. Better breeding, better feeding, good animal health, better reproduction. All of these tools make our cows better cows. They make you more money as a farmer, and they reduce the environmental footprint of these cows. It's a win-win situation. When you improve production, productivity of the cows through better feeding, better breeding, better health, you have lower emissions and you have more money in your pocket.
Because, Steve, you are a geneticist, and we have mentioned that genetics is one of the important things that we can do to improving this. How do you see this? What do you think is the most important to select for?
Well, I actually agree with everything Frank just said, and actually Czech farmers should be really proud of what they've done the last 30 years, because to actually, as Frank said, reduce cow numbers by over half, yet at the same time increase production in 30 years, they actually... Probably the US is one of the great examples of that. They were at 25 million cows and now down to 9 million cows, and at the same time producing more milk. It's a really great story they should be very proud of. So, and they've done a lot of that through education and farm management. I know you've taken a lot of people to the USA, and a lot of great US genetics have been used in the Czech Republic. And So what we need to be doing is a lot of the same, but also we've got tools that will help us even accelerate that process going forward. Things such as, you know, genomic testing and sex semen usage. So they should be really proud of what they've done, but it's not wholesale change going forward. It's tweaks and using the knowledge we've got to make even greater progress.
If we will still stay at the site of genetics, so today when we have a possibility of genotyping animals, and we have also the systems that are monitoring health of the cow, timing of the heat, all these things, digestion, do you think that these are really the best ways to utilize to improve even more?
Absolutely, absolutely. You know, the systems for measuring health, for measuring, natural heats, we have the opportunity to bring down hormone usage. We have the opportunity to bring down antibiotic usage to have a healthier cow. Genetics, we have so much more information today than we did 15, 20 years ago on health. So we can breed cows that are more fertile, more mastitis and disease resistant, which is going to mean we have cows, more cows that stay in the herd to get to their third, fourth, and fifth lactation and fulfill their genetic potential. And then we'll need less replacements.
Hey, Frank, the methane is only one of the carbon, let's say the gases. There is also oxynitrogen and CO2. Why farmers are attacking only because of methane?
Yeah, so there's carbon dioxide, as you said, and then there's methane, and there's nitrous oxide. Methane is almost 30 times more powerful than carbon dioxide in trapping heat from the sun, almost 30 times. But nitrous oxide is 265 times more powerful. So your question is well taken. Why do we focus on methane and why don't we focus on nitrous oxide if it's so much more powerful? Well, there's much more methane produced than nitrous oxide. So even though methane is less potent than nitrous oxide, we're producing more of it. So it is true that the main greenhouse gas in animal agriculture is methane, okay? There's just no doubt in my mind about that. And while we also need to deal with nitrous oxide, our big challenge is the methane. The thing about methane is nothing other than energy. When you heat your home at home, what you're burning there is natural gas, and that's methane. When you cook a meal with gas at home, that's natural gas, methane. So it's energy. That methane is only a problem if you just let it go into the air. If you utilize it, for example, by converting methane into vehicle fuels or into power, then it's not a problem but a utility.
So what are the sources of methane coming from the agriculture and from the cow production?
So the methane sources from agriculture there are several. The number one is enteric emissions, and that means the methane that's generated in their stomach, in their rumen. Okay, that's the number one. The number two is the manure from those animals. When it's stored, it releases methane. And the number three is rice patties, so rice production. There are some others, but these are the three most important.
What it is interesting that many years ago we had much more cattle than today, and no one was speaking about methane. So isn't it a little strange that we have started just now to speak about methane? Or why do we concentrate only on methane? Is it because probably methane is only one gas that we can do something with it?
No, it's just a hot topic. You know, every couple of years a new hot topic pops up. A few years ago, it was the ozone hole, then it was acid rain, now it's global warming, okay?
Well, generally, the governments are trying to solve the situation because they are under pressure of, let's say, politicians are under pressure, so trying to find different ways how to reduce the total pollution of methane. And in some countries, they are trying to go down with cow numbers, they purchase farms from farmers like in Netherlands and so on. Do you think this is one of the ways how we can obtain the goal that we have?
I don't think so. I think it's a poor approach, and here's why. If you, let's say, in a certain country, reduce 500 cows, let's say, to reduce the carbon footprint of your country, then the demand for the products of those 500 cows will still be there. And instead of the country that used to produce it, now some other country will produce it, And that means they will now produce the emissions that previously occurred there.
And transportation, right?
That's called leakage.
Yeah, yeah.
Yes, that's called leakage. That's not a reduction of emissions. It's a shifting of emissions from one location to another. And that doesn't really do the job. What does do the job is for us to reduce emissions where we are instead of getting rid of animals.
So probably the ideal situation would be that everyone would be able to produce enough product in his own area because he would have excellent genetics, excellent food. There would not be extra transportation of the product to other countries. Would this be ideal situation or not? And is it possible worldwide?
No, it's not possible worldwide. Worldwide, we are completely dependent upon international trade.
Mm-hmm.
We can no longer produce all the foods that we need. For some of the reason is, look, I live in California, where we have warm climate, where we can produce a lot of things such as nuts and avocados and citrus and so on. Many of the things you can't produce here. We need to transport them here if you want to eat them.
Mm-hmm.
And similarly, there is trade throughout the world. Okay, if you were to have no imports of food items to your supermarkets, your shelves would be pretty empty.
Mm-hmm.
So we need trade. And in fact, people always think transportation is the most important pollutant contributor for our food, but that's not true.
Mm-hmm.
The transport these days is very efficient with huge ships, with huge semi-trucks packed to the hilt. That is not the main source of emissions from our food. The main source of emissions from our food occurs on the farm. And that's the negative news for our farmers. But the positive news is we can do something about it.
Mm-hmm.
And when we do something about it, then we can be part of a solution for reducing climate impacts. And I wanted to say this too. You asked earlier, is the focus on methane, is that warranted or is that too narrow-minded? The answer is very clearly, it's too narrow-minded.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
We cannot just focus on methane. We have to look at the big picture. We need to have healthy cows. We need to have productive cows. We need to have farmers that make a good income, as well as we need to reduce our carbon footprint, also keep an eye on nitrogen and so on. These days, a farmer is no longer just doing a simple job. These are complicated jobs,
mm-hmm.
and they require help from people like you and I.
Mm-hmm. At the beginning, when we were first time, we had the information about the methane in cows. The number that were estimated were much more higher than we can see today in some statistics. Why is this?
Well, back in 2006, a international organization said that globally 18%, that's 1/8, 18% of our greenhouse gases come from livestock.
Mm-hmm.
There were some issues around how they derived that number, and also what kind of methodology they used. It has since been reduced from 18 to 14.5 and now 12. But even the 12 is not a number that applies to the Czech Republic. Mm-hmm. That's a global average.
Oh, yeah.
Mm-hmm. In Czech Republic, all livestock combined emits something around 5% of total greenhouse gases. By the way, the same is true in the United States, in Germany, in most developed countries.
If agriculture has only 5% or 12%, who is the strongest polluter in the world? What is the main reason why we have a global warming, basically?
Okay, so I have to be specific, okay? The 5% is animal agriculture.
Animal.
All of agriculture in most developed countries is 10%. Animal agriculture is 5%. So what's the main contributor of human activity to global warming? The main contributor is the use of fossil fuels. That's oil, coal, and gas, and all the industries that burn it. And that is carbon that was down in the ground for a very long time.
Mm-hmm.
And that carbon that is down in the ground that was there for so long is the biomass from hundreds of millions of years ago. Plants and animals like dinosaurs, they died, decayed, fossilized, and they accumulated down there.
Mm-hmm.
Until 70 years ago when we started to dig this out and burn it. And by doing so, by burning that carbon, we're taking the carbon from the ground, we're putting it into the air, and when the sun hits those carbon molecules, they heat up. And the gas resulting is carbon dioxide, CO2, And that is by far the most important contribution of humans to climate change.
So when you mentioned that methane, after, let's say, 10, 12 years, basically disappear as a part of the cycle, but the CO2 not, CO2 is maybe 1,000 years still in the atmosphere, is it even worth to do something with methane if we know that we cannot change the level of the CO2?
The answer to this is we have to work on everything, okay? Not just the one or the other, but all of the above. We have to reduce emissions from fossil fuels, and we can do so. We can be much more efficient with our vehicles. The car you drive today is much cleaner than the car your father drove 50 years ago, 30 years ago, or the car your grandfather drove. And your car today is more fuel efficient.
I hope.
And more fuel efficient means less emissions. The same is true for your cows. The cows that you have today on a farm are much more efficient than the cows 10, 20, 30 years ago. And more efficient means less emissions. And so we should not just focus on reducing methane. We need to focus on reducing everything while keeping people in business. Because otherwise it's not going to happen.
We need farmers. We cannot be without farmers.
We need farmers. Come on. We all are completely dependent upon farming, just like we are dependent on doctors and nurses. Health and food are the two most important societal sectors. Health and food. And we need to understand that without the farmers, we won't have food. People associate supermarkets with food. They no longer associate farmers with food, but it comes from the farms. We have to work with our farmers to grow the food, to do it sustainably. And in order to do that, we need to make sure that they can make a living.
Steve, Frank mentioned that one of the ways how we can even improve the situation on the side of cattle is to be more feed efficient. Are there any traits we can select for in genetics, or do you think they will be developed, or how do you see the situation with this?
Good question, Mirek. Yeah, feed efficiency is there, and it's been there for a while, and residual feed intake is in several of the indexes we use. But what I would say for the most inefficient cows on a dairy farm are those replacements that are not producing any milk, and also the cows in the sick pen. So it doesn't matter how feed efficient a cow is, if it's in the sick pen, it's not what we want. So my advice would be having cows, you know, focus at getting the health right is a great opportunity first. So let's use genomic testing. Let's rank our females. Let's use sex semen to breed from our best. And we can rapidly reduce health incidences on farm. So the average age of our cow is a little longer. What that means, we need less replacements, less unproductive animals. And then once we've got the health managed well, we can then add more feed efficiency in there. The nice thing is, as we breed for health, inadvertently we get feed efficiency as well, because average sized animals that are fertile, they're healthy, are feed efficient.
What does it mean in your words to breed for health? Should we select strictly if I have a problem with laminitis? Should I select bulls only on PTA for laminitis, or should I use some index? Or how do you see this?
Good question. But you know, the farm has to look. What are their issues? How do I make, you know, if your problem is mastitis on your farm, you probably need to put a little bit more emphasis on mastitis. And if it's lameness, you probably need to look at your system. But also look at a trait like lameness resistance. So there now are traits that specifically target, you know, the incidence of that health issue. So putting more emphasis on the specific trait can help.
Frank, you have recently returned from the World Climate Meeting at Dubai, and you mentioned that there was a very interesting study published by FAO, showing where we would be if we would do nothing, then where will be the level of the gases in 2030 or 50, and then also where we would like to be, and which factors are the most important for obtaining the goal that we have. Could you say something about this?
Yes, so the United Nations Food and Agriculture Organization, FAO, published a report called the Pathways Report. And in it, they showed a large column in a graph, and this column said, this is where we will be by 2050 if we don't do anything to reduce methane and other greenhouse gases. And this is where we want to be. If we want to go from here to here, they said, then there are different ways of achieving those reductions. And so they found that the number one most important reduction is improved performance of cattle, mm-hmm. of cows, for example. The number two is improved breeding. The number three is better feeding, and then improved health. Mm-hmm. Don't just think of Czech Republic, okay? Think globally, okay? These are the most important ones. Increasing performance, increasing, better breeding, better health and feeding. And what was interesting in there, in this report issued by the FAO in Rome, was that the second least effective way of reducing the carbon footprint of animal source foods like meat, milk, and eggs, the second least effective way was a dietary change of the population.
What does it mean? Does it mean that people would not eat like what we like today, like to eat meat, drink milk?
Right. So what that means is if we as a society were to switch to become vegetarians or vegans, then it would have an impact in reducing emissions, but a very slight one. That's what that report said, and I found it very interesting because what we hear and read in the media sounds very differently.
It is very difficult to imagine what is the footprint of one vegan compared to me. I am not vegan. How can you measure it?
So first of all, I personally think people should eat what they choose. It's a personal choice, okay? I will never put somebody down because they say they are vegan or vegetarian or so. So that's the first point. The second point is, if you so choose to change your diet to affect your carbon footprint, let's say you as an omnivore eating everything were to say you want to go vegan for 1 year. Mm-hmm. And that shift from omnivore to vegan would cause a 0.8 ton reduction of your greenhouse gases. 0.8 tons. Now you'll ask me, Frank, is that a lot or is that not a lot?
Is it per day or is it
per year?
Per year.
0.8 ton.
I cannot measure if it is a lot when I cannot compare it.
Okay, so is 0.8 tons a lot or not? I give you a comparison.
Is it a lot?
I give you a comparison.
Yeah.
I just flew from California to Europe, and this flight per passenger generated 1.6 tons of greenhouse gases. So remember, going vegan for 1 year is 0.8 tons. One flight per passenger is 1.6 tons. And that means if I were to try to offset my flight, I would have to go vegan for 2 years. One flight per passenger equals 2 years of being vegan.
So it looks like that there is no problem to be vegan, but it is not the solution that we need.
That's the point I'm making. Will it have a reduction? Yes, but a minor reduction.
I saw that much more important fact is that there is too much waste because it costs us a lot of money to produce high quality milk, high quality meat. And then big part of this really is not consumed.
That's correct. The FAO, the same organization we are talking about, estimates that globally 40%, that's 40% of all food grown and produced is never eaten, is thrown away. Not just in developed countries. Also in developing countries, but in developing countries, that waste occurs at the farm level because people can't harvest on time, transport to distribution and processing centers and so on. In developed countries like this one, the food waste occurs at the consumer level, in restaurants, in our private homes.
I'm a little afraid, Steve, that in our we call it developed world. It's quite self-confidence, but we mean that it is Western Europe, United States, North America. And then we produce a lot. We have a way how to solve it. We have a lot of the waste, but still we can do something with it. In countries like we have spent 2 years in India, many people don't have even time to think about it because they have even problem how to find something to eat. Is it true? Can they, at these circumstances, think about how to reduce global warming?
That's a really good question because it's strange how we we work on the situations of where we live. You know, we're very fortunate when we're living in Europe or America that we have the choice of a diet. So many people around the world do not have a choice of a diet. And actually, they would love the opportunity to have, you know, access to high quality, you know, nutritious and delicious food like, you know, milk that we take for granted. Mm-hmm. So it's a challenge for a lot of families in places like India. But it's also, when I was there, they're taking the responsibility seriously. It's going to be a challenge, but it's a great opportunity for them to increase the efficiency of their animals. Look where Czech was 30 years ago. Probably India is in a similar position today. So the opportunity to move forward with more efficient animals in countries like India, probably a different type animal, one that can cope with the environment, because we always talk about high genetics and genetic progress, but it's always the right genetics for that situation. And I think they have some great opportunities.
Looks like that the cow is not the one who is guilty, but it's basically a hero, because the cow is giving us still better standard of living. And you mentioned that one way how to improve the situation to have better cows and do maximum for it. But you also mentioned yesterday at the university during your presentation that we already today have a technologies how we can also benefit from the methane produced by cows. Can you say something about that?
Yeah, so there are two different aspects of methane. When you store manure, animal manure, it generates methane. The methane goes into the air. But you can cap the manure storage so that the gas cannot escape. You can trap it. And then you can convert that methane gas into transportation fuel for semi-trucks, for buses, and replace diesel. So this manure-derived gas can become a transportation fuel and really make you money because you can sell it. Mm-hmm. That's what's happening in California today. Our farmers, so many farmers have done that already, covered their lagoon, convert biogas to transportation fuels, that they are now not just selling milk, but they are also selling what we call carbon credits. Mm-hmm. That's the one way.
Here in Europe, we don't really produce fuel for trucks, but we have many biogas stations to produce electric power. Is it similar?
It used to be like that, that biogas was converted into power, but we no longer do it because power in the United States is relatively cheap. Mm-hmm. It's much more expensive here. The mm-hmm. better economic model for the United States is to convert the biogas into fuel. That could be renewable natural gas. It could be hydrogen. Could be, you know, mm-hmm. other types of fuel.
But agriculture, we need to have high quality fertilizers, and those are those that are from farm animals. When you produce the fuel from the manure, don't you lose the quality of the fertilizer on the amount of the fertilizer?
No, you don't. When you put manure into a digester, that's what we call that. You know, when you cover the lagoon, you put the manure in there, and you extract the methane, then what you're extracting from that manure is only the energy. You're not extracting nutrients, but only energy. Mm-hmm. The nutrient, the nitrogen, potassium, phosphorus, and so on, that's in the manure stays there. Mm-hmm. And so you're not losing nutritional quality for the fertilizer that comes out of the digester, but you're just extracting the energy.
Mm-hmm. We see that European Union has also some strategy to return the carbon into the land. Do you do something similar in the United States?
There are two different ways you can do that. Okay. So it's called soil carbon sequestration, where plants take carbon out of the air in the form of CO2, and they put it into the plant material, some above ground. The majority of the carbon goes below ground into the roots. And then soil microbes come and take that carbon from the roots and suck it into the soil. That's called soil carbon sequestration. Mm-hmm. So we can improve soil carbon sequestration by better management. Okay. Yes, we can do that. There are also other ways of capping carbon and keeping it in the ground. It's called, carbon capture. Okay. You can take CO2 from whatever source and get it back in the ground, but that's not so much for agriculture. It's more for other industries.
Is the effect same, or does it matter if we will do this technology on the high fertile land or on marginal land? Is it same, or do you see differences? Does it matter on the quality of land when we will do this?
Soil carbon sequestration works the best on low quality soils. Because if you have low quality soils, then you have little microbial activity in there. Mm-hmm. Because the microbes don't have enough to eat, not mm-hmm. enough nutrients. But if you now add manure to low quality soil, then therefore you add nutrients to that low quality soil, and the microbes in the ground will explode in numbers. More microbial activity will pull more carbon out of the air. And that means low quality soils have a higher potential to suck that carbon out of the air and store it down there. If you have rich soils, then the relative potential of rich soils to carbon capture is small.
Well, but the system is based on that we will put carbon into the land and we will not intensively work on it, like we will not plug it. Correct. But on other side, when you put fertilizers on it, you need to take them, get them inside the land. So you need to plug it to get farm fertilizers into it. Isn't it a little bit in conflict?
So, if you, let's say, graze cattle, let's just say you do that. And the animals walk around and they defecate and urinate on your land, then you're adding the nutrients to the soil, right? So in that case, you're not plowing, you're not tilling, the carbon stays in the ground. Mm-hmm. If you take animal manure and you, let's say, fertilize corn with it or soy with it or something else, then you also take carbon out of the air. But if you then go and you plow it, then all that carbon comes back out.
So basically, it doesn't give sense. Okay. Let's say there is a country that is not rich enough, so it is very difficult to invest to such a system like we have in California. Not everyone can do it. There are another possibilities like feed additives. Can you explain us better how it works and how much we can do with this?
So the main source of methane from animal agriculture, as I said before, is enteric emission. That's the methane that comes out of the mouth, comes from the rumen, and it's produced by methane-forming microbes. Mm-hmm. There are additives. These look like powders that you add to the diet that you give to the animals. And these additives change the composition of microbes in the rumen. Mm-hmm. So they defeat those microbes that produce methane. That's one sort of feed additives. The other sort of feed additives are those that inhibit production of methane. So the first group here reduces about 10% of methane. The second group produces about 30% of methane. And so they will be an important part of our toolbox, but they will also not be what we call the silver bullet, meaning the one and all solution. It is a combination that we need, a toolbox of genetics, of feeding methods, of manure treatments, and so on, that help farmers to do the job.
That's perfect. Steve, do you think that at current last 10 years, the genetic components are really coming with the genetic generation interval very down? Do you think this is something that helped to do big progress in breeding, but also does it come with higher reliability of our selection? Can we really rely on such a small traits with heritability that is very low?
Good question, Merrick. You know, we talked about the great progress that has been done the last 30 years, but with tools such as genomic testing, which came in around 2009, that brought the generation interval down from 5 years, around 5 years, down to around 2 years. That is huge when you're trying to make genetic progress. So what that has meant is we've just accelerated genetic progress over the last, 14 years now. Doesn't time fly? Mm-hmm. But at the same time, we've got, we're not just genomic testing the males. We can genomic test and rank the females of a herd. So that means we can use sex semen and only get our replacements from, you know, the top percentile that we want to use, which again helps accelerate the genetic progress further. You mentioned about, heritability and reliability. And just because something is lower heritability does not mean it's not important. And so I've had all my life people saying, oh, ignore that trait, it's low heritability. Well, if it's important, something like lameness resistance and mastitis resistance, we shouldn't ignore it. We actually, if we make a mess of it, it takes a longer time to correct. So it's very important we look after these, and I say it again, the health incidents, the health traits, so we have these longer lasting cows. Because if we've got a 37% replacement rate on a herd, and we can bring that down to 30% replacement rate, that means we can make more milk from the same amount of animals. But in total animals, we need less because we need less replacements. So that's we can reduce methane, make more milk, and actually make more money for as a dairy farmer. There isn't a trade-off in making the right genetic decisions.
So with this genetic progress, basically we produce more high-quality heifers. And these high-quality heifers, even they need much more better management, for example, at the time when they are in the milking time in the boxes. So do you think that the new traits that are targeted into the health of the cows, resistance against scours, against pneumonia, are a really significant help? Because we know that as better is the quality of your care for small cows, as better is milk production later, and probably as better is also health of the animal.
Absolutely, and Thomas knows, as you know, from MTS as well as anybody, that that calf health is really important. Having calves that, you know, flourish from day one is really important. So identifying bulls that have outliers for particular health traits, and that could be calf scours, you know, respiratory issues, is really important. So we're able to do that now. We're able to test, take out those outliers. So right from the start, genetics are getting a good opportunity.
So I feel that because I'm already quite old man, you know, it's exhausting. So it is time to give chance to someone younger, more optimistic. But my conclusion would be, based on what we have discussed, I think that really farmers should be proud what they did.
Absolutely.
Because they are only small community, maybe 1-2% of the community. Very often it is measured by HDP or economic different levels. But where we would be if the farmers would not supply us by such a high quality products, and they spend their 365 days from the morning till the evening. And it doesn't matter if it is small private farmer or manager of large farm, because whenever you are, you must do the best professional job. And you must also defend agriculture against people that are not inside agriculture, because as more people are living in the town, it is more difficult to educate them how this works. So at the end, do you think that this is worth of emphasis to invest to good communication with people in towns, in schools, with children, explain them how important is it, because where they would find this information?
So in my opinion, it is not just important, I think it's critical. But I want to say one thing, and that is, I don't think we need to defend ourselves. Defense is not the right word, because we have no reason to defend. We are producing food, and that means we are doing one of the most important things of society. But we have to explain what we do and why we do it, and not just explain, but also listen what the concerns are out there in the cities. If people have concerns about something we do, we can't just say, well, that's too bad. We have to think about, all right, if the people who buy our products have a problem with how we produce it, then we need to think about, can we make some changes? So I'm not in the camp of people saying, we are just perfect, we just keep going and don't have to change anything. We will continually change, like all the other industries do too. But we deserve, in agriculture, to really be worked with. We deserve that people will work with us and not against us, because we have a very important mission, one of the most important ones of society. We are producing food, we need to do it in the most sustainable way, and society needs to work with us.
And we are educated to do it.
And this is the other thing. You asked me, how important is communication? Not just do we need to do the right thing, but we need to talk about it in ways the people who consume our food understand.
Yeah, yeah.
We always talk to ourselves. We need to talk to the rest of the world.
I like Steve has a theory that most important is if his wife, who is cooking at home, consider that this is healthy and this is good for her. Because this is what our wives check. They
are responsible for the quality of the food. Do you agree with this?
Mirek, you know I agree with that statement. We've spoke about it many times. I was born on a dairy farm. I've been in this industry all my life, which is probably too many years to mention on this podcast. But I'm really proud of the sector and the industry I work in. I'm proud of the progress we've made. I'm proud of the cow. I think the cow's got superpowers. We've said she's part of the solution. She isn't the problem. She is a big part of the solution. And she produces this delicious, nutritious, drink that a lot of the world would love to have more of. And we're very fortunate and take it for granted. But there's no additives. Milk is such a healthy product. And I do get concerned about some of the milk alternatives and some of the ingredients, the additives that go in there, preservatives, whatever, that have long names too long for me to. That's a Dr. Frank, subject some of these. And I prefer to put this healthy product into my mouth that I know exactly what it is. My wife has the same opinion. My wife has another thing. There's another part of my wife. She's a consumer, like we're consumers. We have to get that message to the broader consumer because they want us to look after the cow well, which farmers do. They get up in the morning, they spend lots of hours. Our husbandry is excellent. I'm really proud that genetic companies are now, ourselves in particular, are focusing on health because that's what we want. We don't want sick animals that are inefficient. So we've got lots to be proud of. I agree, we shouldn't be defending, we should be educating and be transparent about what we're doing in producing this delicious, nutritious product.
So it looks like the conclusion, it is not methionine that is our biggest challenge. We know today what we should do and we can do it if we will really work hard. What do you consider as the real biggest challenge for agriculture in next 20, 30 years?
I think the greatest challenge right now is to make ends meet. Many farmers don't make enough money to sustain the operation, to sustain the family. And that's one of the reasons why we see farmers protesting all over Europe, all over the world. They are wondering, can we be sustainable if we don't make enough money to feed our families? And the answer is no. So I think this is a big problem, globally, that farmers just don't get what they deserve for the hard work they do. And that's sustainability, all the other issues around environmental quality, around animal welfare, around workers and food safety and so on, they can all be addressed. But they can only be addressed if the farmers get what they deserve. Otherwise, they'll get out of business and then we are all at loss. Because if they go, then where will our food come from?
No one will start again, probably.
I 100% agree. A great example about how farmers are not fairly treated is go to the supermarket and buy a bottle of water, or the gas station on your way home and buy a bottle of water, because you can probably buy a bottle of milk cheaper than you can buy a bottle of water. That seems absolutely ridiculous to me. The work that goes in to produce that delicious, nutritious milk compared to a bottle of water, and yet it's one of the cheapest products in the supermarket.
I promise I will now leave my chair to my son. Thank you very much for coming and great job you did.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Takže dobrý den, i za mě zdravím diváky TV Zemědělec. Jak vidíte, tak genetika funguje. S tátou jsme se vyměnili poměrně jednoduše. Vypadá to skoro furt stejně. Speaking from a younger generation's perspective, all of that has been mentioned before is great information, but I think there are a few questions that need to be raised or arguments we need to speak about of what most of the young people think about when they consider how animal agriculture is affecting the environment and emissions and such. And you already touched on the topic of what's the effect of becoming vegan on the emissions? And what actually is the effect of the dietary changes? That is not that much as maybe a lot of people would like it to be. One of the popular trends that used to be, but still is, especially in the US, but also in Western Europe, is meatless Mondays. So what do you think about this this concept?
Well, if you consider that the total contribution of all livestock in a country like the United States is 4%, if the entire country were to go vegan as the extreme, so no more animal source foods but only plant-based foods, then that number would go from 4% down to 2.6%. So there would be a reduction. Now, but you're asking Meatless Monday, what would that do? If 330 million Americans would not eat meat and milk and dairy, eggs one day a week, Monday, it would reduce the carbon footprint of the nation by 0.3%. 0.3%. So whether that's a lot or not is up to your, evaluation, but I don't think it's very much. But it is, of course, a reduction.
Yeah, as you said, it's up to everyone's feelings if who wants to eat something or not. But it's good to be heard that it we might have different options to turn to, which might have bigger effect. But that logically brings us to another topic, which is not so far from that, and it was mentioned again a short while ago. There are many alternatives, let's call those, for meat or dairy products or other products. What is their not only effect on the human health, but also how are they doing? You both are coming from the United States, so how both of them are successful in how popular they are among people inside the United States? Is it still a big trend or not anymore?
Well, I have just seen the recent trends and the recent numbers. And so these plant-based alternatives have been promoted heavily in the media over the last few years. And so it sounded in the media as if there were that wave, a major movement into these plant-based alternatives. I just saw the numbers. If you add them all together, all the plant-based alternatives versus the original, the meat, the milk, and so on, and all the alternatives together make up 0.3% of the total protein consumption. 0.3%. The remaining 99.7 are the animal-sourced originals. So I don't think that's very much. And if I look at the stock market prices for these products, then there's a very clear indication that it's not going this way, but it's going that way.
Mm-hmm. And Steve, I remember you have a great story with your wife. She tried some plant-based burgers, right?
Yeah, so my wife is a real animal lover, and I wish she treated her husband as well as she treats the dogs in our house. So she's not a vegan, but she's always floating with the idea because of she's very affectionate to animals. So when Impossible Burgers came out, she was really curious to try one. And we did. We went. We did try one. We didn't need two, and she enjoyed it. Actually, it was a pleasant eating experience. But my wife's she goes into a bit more detail and decided to look at the ingredients. And her reply was, "Yes, I did like it, but that will be the last one I eat." And it's not because we're just. We are really conscious about eating food. We love our vegetables. We eat lots of fruit and vegetables. But we are a little bit nervous of food preservatives, and food additives. So that's what we stay away from in our house. And like we've said, it's people can take their choice of how they want to, control their diets or have their diets. That's our choice, and that was our experience.
Thank you.
Tomas, there's one thing I want to add to this discussion. You asked about the healthfulness. Sometimes people say, well, it's dairy milk, let's say, is nutritionally the same as an almond drink or a oat drink. And that's not true. It might be the case that these different beverages have similar protein levels. But milk is much more than protein. Milk is a very nutrient-dense food item containing much more than essential amino acid. It contains vitamins and minerals that are difficult, sometimes impossible to get from other sources. And they are contained in a way that's easily digestible to us. Okay. So not just is it a nutrient-packed package, but it is very easy to digest for humans, for the most humans, except for those who have lactose intolerance. Mm-hmm. I just wanted to share one more experience with you. I recently met one of the world's most famous scientists in and around the functional aspects of milk. And so he for decades was wondering why human breast milk and why cow milk contain so many carbohydrates called oligosaccharides that their offspring cannot digest. That their offspring cannot digest. Why would the mother invest so much energy producing these oligosaccharides when her baby or her calf cannot digest it? It was a mystery for many, many years. They have solved the mystery. These oligosaccharides are not made to feed the offspring. They are made to feed the microbes, the digestive microbes that are in the calf or the baby, and improve and foster the digestive health of those.
It's amazing. But I think everything that, you know, nature made is amazing. So it's even, I don't get it sometimes how we as humans think that we can create nutrition that should be better than what nature made already. Like, is there something better than milk? Not. There's nothing so complex. But Steve, you mentioned it, that brought me to another topic. You mentioned your wife as an animal lover. And most of the people, of course, are. And that's another, might be another concern of the younger generation. Animal welfare. That's a huge topic. But I think it's important to be told that we do have many reserves. There's a lot we can do better also as farmers. But on the other hand, it's, again, just like with reducing methane, it's all in favor for the farmer to take care the best he can about the animals. So what is your opinion and experience?
Absolutely. I mentioned earlier I was born on a dairy farm, and my father is... They were part of the family. You know, they were a really important part of our livelihood. You know, they created our living. So we took care of those cows, and it was a small herd of cows. And, yeah, I think the most distraught I've ever been is when, you know, one of my cows were, you know, not well. And actually, I travel many countries. And on the whole, you know, the dairy farmer should be really commended. They take great care from birth right the way through, because they're an important part of their profitability. The better welfare you have for looking after your cows, the more profitable that dairy farm will be. As I said earlier, the most inefficient cow on a dairy farm is the one in the sick pen. So they do a lot to avoid cows becoming sick. Actually, I'm against organic because I like animals to be treated like me. If there is a vaccination, I want it. If I'm sick and I need antibiotics, yes, I want them. I don't want you can give me the homeopathic remedy, but give me the antibiotics as well, because I want to get better. Mm-hmm. And if an animal is sick, it is treated separately, and that milk never goes into the food chain. Each tanker of milk is checked, so there's never any antibiotics getting into the food chain from milk. But what I would say, there are occasionally some farms that could improve their animal welfare, and I won't defend those. You know, we will help educate them, but it's important that all dairy farmers, all livestock farmers, take that animal husbandry and welfare responsibility seriously. And I think that's the point you was getting at. But I have to say, 99% of the people I work with, I'm really proud to have a lot of dairy farmers in the UK and around the world as friends, and really proud of how they look after their animals.
Yeah, I fully agree, even for Czech farmers. Of course, you might find people that should not be in the industry, but most of them are terribly hardworking. It's such a hard job. And unfortunately, from the general public, you're not getting a lot of respect. But I think, Frank, there's no better person at this table to ask, because you have, as a professor, you have a daily contact with students, with the youngest generation. So Even though you work on an agriculture university, which is of course different than other universities, How often can you see, or how often are you hearing some bigger concerns or even aggression from the students towards animal welfare and these occasions?
So first of all, I completely agree with you that it's an outlier situation where somebody mistreats or abuses animals. But it does happen. It does happen. And every farmer should know it is so easy to be caught on tape these days because everybody has a smartphone. If something goes wrong, the likelihood for it to come out is high. So please, please don't cut corners. Do never, ever abuse an animal and make sure you are maximizing their health and welfare. Particularly the young generation is very, very sensitive to animal neglect, to animal abuse. And we all should be. We all should be. It is my opinion that if a neighbor of yours is neglecting or abusing animals, you should give them a warning. If they still do it, we in agriculture should self-police and get rid of them. They have no place if they don't take good care of the animals.
Yeah, exactly. I think it's very important to disclose that just like in any business or any human interaction, you have people that are the role models. Yeah. Then you have the average people who are doing a good job, but also you will always find people that are not behaving or acting as they should be. So, but let's jump to maybe one of the last topics. And that is that oftentimes, also from the young people, but I think across the generations, you can hear the argument or just the thought in their head. So we are actually using a lot of an arable land for plants that are for animal production. So wouldn't it actually be better and just easier to grow crops only for human nutrition? Wouldn't that be the simplest thing to do?
Well, it's a little complicated, and I need to spend a little time on this because it's so important. So it is true that the majority of agricultural land in the world is used to feed animals that then feed humans eventually. That's true. And so many of the critics of animal agriculture say, wouldn't it be so much better if we were to just convert all that land into growing crops only? Theoretically, yes, but practically, no. Why not? Because not all land is created equal. And I show you a simple depiction that only requires me to use a sheet of paper and a business card. So imagine this sheet of paper here being the entire surface of the earth. That's everything. I now fold this sheet of paper, and I fold it twice until it's roughly the size of a postcard. What you see now is all the land in the world. The difference between this and the large sheet is water and ice. Mm-hmm. This is all the land in the world.
That's probably the blue planet, right? The blue planet?
Right. The blue is the rest, but mm-hmm. This is the land.
Yes.
Now we talk about agricultural land. This is my business card, and the equivalent amount of land of my business card is all agricultural land. So this is all land in the world. This is all agricultural land in the world. Now I take my business card and I fold it into one part, that's two-thirds, and the other part, that's one-third. And then I rip it into pieces. So again, this is all agricultural land. The larger of these two pieces, the two-thirds piece, is all the agricultural land that's called marginal. Marginal means you cannot grow crops there. Why not? There might not be enough water, the soil might not be fertile enough, might be too rocky, too hilly. For whatever reason, you cannot grow crops here. But it's two-thirds of all agricultural land, this marginal land. What do we do here? We use it for grazing with ruminant livestock, such as cows, sheep, goats. That's what we use on two-thirds of agricultural land, the marginal land. And the reason is it cannot be used for other purposes to grow human food.
So we're not left with much.
We are left with the third of my business card, and that is the so-called arable land. Marginal land, arable land. This arable land can be used to grow crops directly. And that's how little we have in the world. Here you can grow food crops that feed people directly or our animals. And let's not forget, this marginal land needs to be fertilized. And globally, half of all fertilizers are chemical fertilizers. The other half of the fertilizers used in the world are organic fertilizers. And they stem from animal manure.
And people usually don't like not the natural, but the synthetic fertilizers. Yes.
Well, these chemical or synthetic fertilizers have the issue around them to be very energy intensive to be produced. Okay, it takes a lot of energy to pull nitrogen out of the air and make it into fertilizer nitrogen. It's called the Haber-Bosch procedure. Mm-hmm. It's very energy intensive, and that means it's carbon intensive. Plus, there are times like these where you have a war involving two major European countries that produce 30% of the world's synthetic fertilizers. We have a shortage of it. And thank God we have manure coming from animals. Otherwise, we would not be able to fertilize our crops today.
So it sounds like that we should be very precious about every small speed of arable land that we have.
So what I'm telling you is this. The land use, the 70% land use that's agriculture and on marginal land is not a waste of land. It's the best use of that land. And without ruminant livestock, we could not make use of it. And I'm also telling you that this land here needs to be utilized as intensively as possible, because I'm a little over 50 years. When I was a little boy, we had 3 billion people in the world. Today we have 8, and by the time I'm an old man, we will have 9.5. In other words, Tomáš, in my lifetime, human population will have tripled, but the natural resources to feed these people will not have tripled. And that means we need to use any and all resources known to man to feed these people. These resources and these resources.
Well, I would like to use Steve with his experience from traveling all over the world, but you did as well. But so you've lived, Steve, in very different areas and countries in the world. Of course, you're from the UK now. You live in the US for many years, but you also have few years of experience from India. So from your experience and perspective, is this precious land, especially arable land, is it treated with respect in all the countries you visited, or is it not really the way it's supposed to be?
That's it's a tough question, because I'll have to say I probably don't know a really good answer for that one. What I would say, I agree with everything that Dr. Frank has just said, because and I think in Europe and as America, we probably maximize that land we can cultivate better than anywhere else in the world, and there are countries that have land that can be drained or made better and used better. But it comes back to that issue about what the cow can do when we're talking about the dairy industry. I just don't want to be in a world where everything relies on synthetic fertilizer, because as we've talked about milk and what it brings to the equation, more than just protein and calcium, I actually think organic manure brings more to the equation than artificial fertilizer. And, the Earth's core, whether it's marginal land or whether it's, intensive agricultural land, that's a very precious thing. You've talked about how it can lock carbon away. So I think we need to take care of that. I think if we go down a completely synthetic route for fertilizer, it's probably a dangerous place to go.
Sorry, Frank, go ahead.
Well, I just wanted to add this. I've been all over the world as well, and I can tell you that this arable land here is not always treated gently. In many places, the farming of that land is not done in a way that regenerates over time. Mm-hmm. Let's not forget this. Our land is the host, and we are the guests. And being the guest means not to ruin your host's house, but to keep it the way it was. Our land is the host. We are the guests. We have to treat that land gentle enough so that it regenerates, because we need to think not just of ourselves, but also and particularly of the next generations, of our kids and our grandkids. That's very important, okay? And I really feel very strongly about that. We need to think about how do we treat those precious resources? How much is too much? How shall we allow this land to recover from its usage? And that's what we should do. And that's what farmers do, because that's their legacy. This is very important. A farmer always thinks of his legacy, because he or she wants to pass that land on to the next generation. And that means keep it as is or make it better.
Yeah, I think those are very important comments. But so if we conclude the whole meeting today, and I always like to end up positive, but I know both of you are very positive guys. So if we would either have to divide what we are trying to say, what we would like people to take away from this discussion, we can either divide it for farmers directly, because they are responsible for some part of the cake, but also we have many young people, students, we have people from academia. So if you can either address it as a whole, or you can address it as different parts. So what would be, if we wanna end up on the positive note and give more courage to farmers, but also other people in agriculture, what would you tell them?
Well, I think we'll go back to where we started. Let's have a look what we've done the last 70 years. Over the last 70 years in the US, to produce a gallon of milk, we now use 90% less land, around 60% less water, and about 65% less methane. That's unbelievable what we've done in the last 70 years. And that's been with almost by accident, because we weren't working to reduce methane. We were working to make animals more productive, to make better use of the land. So we've managed to grow milk production while bringing cow numbers down by more than half. That's incredible. So what we have to do going forward is not such a major shift. It's small tweaks. As Frank says, it's lots of little parts. Doing a good job with, an even better job with animal welfare. Doing a better job with having a genetic strategy that keeps us going in the right direction, so we can keep making more production from, healthy cows. So I think I was born on a dairy farm, and I started selecting bulls for my father when I was 12, and I was very excited to do that. And I don't think I've been more excited than I am today about how the dairy farm is contributing to the planet. As I've said before, I feel the cow is not the problem. She's part of the solution. And I think that's really exciting. And we have the tools and the vision to take this forward. So, I'm really excited about the industry and the quality, delicious, nutritious milk that we provide to all our customers every day.
Great news. Frank?
So as you know, I live and work in California, and California is the most productive dairy-producing state in the United States. I've come here to the Czech Republic, and I've looked at your data. That's what I do for a living. And I was amazed to see that you're not far away from what California produces to, with respect to your yield, your components, and so on. What your farmers in this country have done over the last 30 years is astounding. If you're not proud of yourselves, then I don't know who should be.
We should be. Yes.
You should be, absolutely. You should be. But that's not to say lean back and you're done. Sustainability is not a destination. It is a path you walk on. Okay. So it is a continuous challenge. And societal expectations change. 5 years ago or so, animal welfare was the number one. Now it's climate change. In the future, it might be nitrogen or something else, biodiversity. Society changes, and society is what buys your products. They are your customers. You can't say, I ignore my customers. If they say, I want X, you need to consider that, right? So, and speaking of which, today, 98%, so almost all of the refrigerators in the United States contain animal source foods such as meat, milk, eggs, 98%. So yes, there are a few people who don't eat it, but the majority does. And because the majority does, and is not going to change in major ways, we need to think about how can we minimize the footprint of these foods and where they are being produced. And how can we work with the farmers to live up to those societal expectations? And that's what I have dedicated my career to. That's what you have dedicated your career to. And I believe that's what you have dedicated yours to. We together can really make an impact, together, hand in hand with the farmers that produce these foods.
Sounds great. Well, as I said, love ending up on the positive note, because, but you said what I wanted to say, so thank you for it. I don't have to say it now, but farmers need to be proud of not only of Czech farmers, but all across the world, what they have achieved, but also for doing a job that not a lot of people want to do. Mm-hmm. Very hard job from early morning to late evening, no vacations, no holidays. So I don't have bigger respect for any other job in this world. Of course, there are many important jobs, but farmers, they are the hardest workers.
Absolutely.
Okay. Yeah. Well, thank you, gentlemen. Já bych vám v podstatě tímto chtěl poděkovat za to, že jste sledovali Téměř zemědělec. Doufáme, že informace, které jste slyšeli, tak především byly určeny vám jako chovatelům pro to, abyste si dodali trošku sebevědomí, abyste byli hrdí na to, co děláte, abyste měli o co důležitější, abyste měli také informace pro to, jak se bránit v každodenním životě a byli schopný se postavit za svoji důležitou práci. So, thank you, gentlemen, again, very much.
Thank you.
Thank you. Okay.